From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember director John Frankenheimer and listen back to a 1990 interview. He died Saturday at the age of 72. He made such classics as The Manchurian Candidate, The Birdmen of Alcatraz, and French Connection 2, as well as the recent films Ronin and Reindeer Games. The poet Kenneth Koch also died on Saturday. We'll feature a short reading he gave on our show. Also today, Grandmaster Flash talks about developing his scratching and mixing techniques on the turntables. His group, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, were one of the first rap groups to gain international success with records like The Message and White Lines. Flash has a new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is promising tough new regulations in response to the past year's scandals at American corporations. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
In a White House news conference, the president previewed a speech he's scheduled to give Tuesday morning on Wall Street. He said to protect American confidence in the markets, it's important for corporate leaders to act legally and ethically. He said the Securities and Exchange Commission will be strengthened with more power to investigate corporate wrongdoing.
We have a duty to every worker, shareholder, and investor in America to punish the guilty, to close loopholes, and protect employee pensions. And we will.
The president also responded to criticism of SEC Chairman Harvey Pitt, saying he has full confidence in Pitt. The president also dismissed as old news questions about his own financial past when he was a director of Texas-based Harkin Energy a dozen years ago. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Former WorldCom executives appeared today before a congressional committee but refused to answer questions about the accounting scandal at the giant telecommunications company. Former chief executive Bernard Edwards invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination when he was asked questions about WorldCom's accounting for nearly $4 billion in expenses. Edwards was forced out in April amid complaints about WorldCom's debts and large personal loans that he'd received from the company. Scott Sullivan, who was fired as WorldCom's chief financial officer last month, also refused to testify. A jury in Georgia is now considering the fate of a former sheriff who's accused of having his successor murdered. Prosecutors accuse Sidney Dorsey of ordering the murder to cover up the corruption during his tenure as sheriff of DeKalb County in Atlanta. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
In closing arguments, prosecutors claimed Sidney Dorsey was a panicking man who killed the one elected to succeed him because he was afraid that his misuse of the sheriff's office would be exposed. An assistant district attorney said 62-year-old Dorsey, quote, found himself at the throttle of the gravy train. Dorsey is charged with 15 counts, including ordering the murder of the new sheriff, Derwin Brown. Attorneys chose not to put on a defense, but defense attorneys told the jury that Dorsey may have made errors in judgment, that he may have been arrogant and sexually immoral, but they claim there is no evidence that he did anything illegal. The prosecution's case was based on the testimony of two men who said they carried out the murder. Both struck immunity deals. Two others were acquitted of the murder charges in a separate trial. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 104 points, or just over 1%, to close at 9,274 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 42 points, or nearly 3%, to close at 1,405. This is NPR News. The Pentagon acknowledged today that a U.S. air attack killed civilians in Afghanistan, but it says the number of casualties isn't clear. Afghan officials say the attack killed more than 40 civilians and hurt more than 100. Scientists at the International AIDS Conference in Barcelona say a wide array of new anti-HIV drugs will soon be available and could offer a new chance for those who've been infected for long periods of time. NPR's Frank Browning reports from Barcelona.
One of the most promising drugs is called T20, which works in a completely new way from the breakthrough drugs of the 1990s called protease inhibitors. The older drugs suppressed HIV by interrupting its ability to reproduce, but only after the virus had already infected the body's immune cells. T20, one of a group of drugs called fusion inhibitors, blocks the virus from getting into immune cells. As a result, HIV has a hard time developing resistance to the drug. There is, however, one drawback. T20 T20 must be administered by regular injections. In addition to T20, researchers said, a new generation of protease inhibitors will appear shortly with increased anti-HIV potency and reduced toxicity. Frank Browning, NPR News, Barcelona.
President Bush has declared federal disasters in 11 more Texas counties that have been hit by heavy rains and flooding. Texas Governor Rick Perry said the damage from the floods is expected to reach nearly $1 billion. The hill country around San Antonio and parts of West Texas have gotten more than 30 inches of rain in the past week, pushing rivers over their banks and sending them spilling over dams. The floodwaters have torn out trees and pushed houses off their foundations. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, providing research and information on health issues to policymakers and the general public at kff.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're postponing our interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, director of Men in Black 2, until tomorrow, so that we can remember the film director John Frankenheimer. He died Saturday at the age of 72 of a stroke resulting from complications after spinal surgery. John Frankenheimer started his career in the 50s directing live TV dramas for the series Playhouse 90. One of his additions was the acclaimed drama The Days of Wine and Roses. He started making movies in the late 50s. His best-known films include The Birdmen of Alcatraz, All Fall Down, The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, I Walk the Line, and French Connection 2. His career was erratic in the 70s and 80s. He attributed that to alcohol. His comeback in the 90s included several Emmy Award-winning HBO and TNT films. His latest HBO film, Path to War, was shown earlier this year. His most recent theatrical releases were Ronin and Reindeer Games. I spoke with Frankenheimer in 1990 after the release of his political thriller, The Fourth War.
You've done several films about the military, 7 Days in May, The Manchurian Candidate. You went to military school as a child, right?
Yes, it's true.
Did you feel like that gave you insights into the military mind at all?
Yes, I do. And I also was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War and things like that. And yes, I do. I feel that it's given me a tremendous insight into the military mind, especially on higher levels, because I was around general officers a lot. And it's helped me.
When you were General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War, what did that entail?
Well, it entailed photographing the general quite a bit. It entailed,
right.
It entailed also doing some training films. I was in the Air Photographic Squadron that did a lot of training films in the United States. That's how I started, actually.
Started making movies?
Yeah.
Well, did you prefer making documentary films for the military to fighting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not a fool. I mean, I'm not crazy. Yeah, I loved it.
I want to ask you a little bit about The Manchurian Candidate, which I think is just a really extraordinary movie. You were the co-producer of the movie. I assume that means that you were one of the people who were behind making it, as opposed to a director who was brought on after the idea.
Yes,
was already in effect.
Yes. In this particular case, George Axelrod and I bought the book. We developed it, and then I ended up directing it, of course.
How did Sinatra get involved with the movie?
Well, Sinatra was the whole element that made the movie possible. The movie had been turned down by every studio in town. And when George Axelrod and I bought the book, we bought it by buying the book in a bookstore. It had been optioned and re-optioned and dropped and never been able to be made. And we knew that Frank Sinatra had read the book and Frank Sinatra was interested in the picture, but he had never really gone the whole nine yards and optioned it. So we optioned it, and without a script, Frank Sinatra committed to it. And, of course, right away, as soon as he committed to it, we had the necessary financing to make the movie.
Did you have any idea he'd be as good as he was in it? I mean, did you have as much faith in his acting abilities when you started?
No. I didn't want to make the movie with Frank Sinatra. I was scared of it. I had heard he was very difficult. I had heard that he treated directors badly, all those things. I expressed these reservations to George Axelrod, and he said, look, he said, I'm going to make the movie with Frank Sinatra, whether you do it or whether you don't. He said, I'll buy you out, but I want to make this movie with Sinatra. Sinatra's going to get this picture made. And if you have problems with Sinatra, he said, I would suggest that you discuss them with him, instead of discussing them with me. And I made an appointment to see Mr. Sinatra. I went up to see him at his house, and I expressed my reservations to him. And he said, look, I guarantee you, whether what you've heard is true, whether what you've heard is not true, there is my side to all that, too. He said, I want to do this picture, I want to work with you, and I feel that we're going to get along just fine. And that was the last discussion we ever had. We got along absolutely fabulously. I loved working with Frank Sinatra. It was a joy making that picture. It was one of the happiest experiences in my life making that picture, and I loved everything that Sinatra did. I mean, he was just a joy to work with, and we've been close friends ever since.
There's a scene I have to ask you about. It's really an extraordinary scene. This is the garden club dream scene. Frank Sinatra is having these recurring nightmares in which he's with all of the men from his army troop from the Korean War. He's with them at a ladies' garden club, and suddenly the ladies' garden club turns into a lot of Korean soldiers, and the head Korean soldier is discussing how he's brainwashing these soldiers into believing that they're at a garden party. And then to show how brainwashed they really are, he has Lawrence Harvey just walk over and strangle to death one of the men. You shot that scene in such a disorienting way. The camera just kind of revolves around all the women of the garden club first, and then suddenly the women are transformed into men, and you're as confused as Frank Sinatra is by all of this. Tell me about how you decided to shoot this scene.
Well, number one, the idea of the scene came right out of Richard Condon's book. He described pretty well what the scene should look like. So it was up to me to interpret it. And the shot that you're talking about is a 360-degree shot, which starts on the stage of a hotel in New Jersey where a woman is talking about hydrangeas, and we pan around the room, and you think that it's just women listening to this, a garden club. And then as the camera completes its 360-degree arc, you suddenly find yourself on a stage in an amphitheater in Korea, and the Chinese psychiatrist is talking about brainwashing. So what we did was we designed a set that could be moved, and it took a little athletic ability from the actors to run from one platform to the other while we were back on the garden club. And the two platforms were on a kind of a railroad track, and we slid one right in place as the camera moved off the first one. But what it did was it set in the audience's mind that this was not just the magic in the movies, that something very strange here was happening, because we never cut. And the audience realizes when you cut. They might not know what it is, but they know that there's been some mechanical device put between them and the story. And I wanted to do it all in one shot. And I think after we accomplished that shot, then we were able to cut to anything that we wanted to do. And we filmed that sequence with about seven or eight different combinations. The women in Korea, the Chinese Manchurian delegates in New Jersey, the actors on the New Jersey stage hotel, the actors in the Korean amphitheater. And we were able to intercut it at will, back and forth. And after the first shot, the suspension of disbelief with the audience was complete. So we were able to kind of manipulate them back and forth whenever we wanted to. And you're right, we did cut it in such a way that it was confusing, and deliberately so.
Now, one of the black men from this same troupe that Sinatra was in has the same dream. But when he has the dream, all of the women from the ladies' club are black. Was that in the novel, or is that your invention, to have the two people have their own version of this same dream?
That was me. What I never did do, I had it done, but I just didn't dare take the shot of it. In the back of the room, we had a white bellboy. But we never did show it. If you look carefully, you can see it.
That's great. It's a wonderful... It's wonderful the way you contrast the two dreams.
You know, I want to tell you one other thing about that movie. That's something that I don't think people are aware of, but I think it's important to say in these days and times, which is that was one of the first movies where the producer and director used a black actor to play a part that was not written for a black.
Uh-huh.
Today it's done quite often, but that was very new at the time, to take the black actor, cast him as the psychiatrist, and that part was not written for a black actor. I've since done it quite a bit, but I just wanted to bring that up.
John Frankenheimer is my guest. The movie was released in 1962. This was just before the Kennedy assassination. Manchurian Candidate was out of circulation for 26 years. It was re-released in 1987. I know Frank Sinatra was a friend of Kennedy. Is that why the movie was out of circulation for so long?
No, you know, no.
It had nothing to do with the assassination?
No.
What is the story?
The story is basically one of greed, of money, as most American stories are. The movie was out of circulation for the simple reason that United Artists carried the movie through a complicated process of Chinese bookkeeping, totally in the red for years and years and years. They had it cross-collateralized with every other movie that Frank Sinatra had made for United Artists. And we were so far in the red that if we had been E.T. and re-released, we would have been in the red. And when this movie finished its run, which was before the president's assassination, there were no ancillary markets as you know them today. There was no tape. There was no cable. There just wasn't anything like that. And what there was network television and then syndicated television. Then you went into the archives, which all these movies did. And, in fact, The Manchurian Candidate did play on network television one time around. However, what they failed to realize was that in 1970, the rights reverted to Frank Sinatra, the rights for re-release. They had just thrown this in as a bone in his contract to get him to agree to other things. And it was the best thing in the world for us because what happened was that a market was developed for the movie. I mean, the press loved the movie. The media loved the movie. And the more people talked about the movie, the less it became possible to see it. And what happened was finally there was a management in place at United Artists for 25 minutes or long enough for us to negotiate a deal with them so that we could start out from scratch and we were neither in the red nor in the black to re-release the movie. And that's what we did. And it turned out very nicely for all of us.
We're listening back to a 1990 interview with film director John Frankenheimer. He died Saturday at the age of 72. We'll hear more of that interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director John Frankenheimer. You were good friends with Bobby Kennedy, and I believe you were with him the night that he was assassinated.
Yes, I was.
And he was supposed to go to your house afterwards. I think you were working with him on campaign ads.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, he was staying at my house, actually, and I drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, and I had done his film and television during his campaign, yes.
What effect did it have on you when he was assassinated?
Terrible. Really, honest to God, Terry, terrible. I had, in layman's terms, a nervous breakdown. I moved to Europe. I stayed in Europe for 7 years after that. It just was really, it was a terrible traumatic effect on me.
Was it because, I mean, I guess I understand why, but was it because you were that close or because of the suddenness and because of the assassination?
All of it.
Yeah.
I was close to him. I honestly believed, and I had let myself be totally convinced that this man would have been a superb president of the United States, and I honestly believe that to this day. And to see that all shattered in that one horrible moment was just more than I could accept.
I
had a very bad time after it.
So you left the States for a while?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I know it was because of that. I kind of made believe it was for other reasons, but that was basically what the reason was.
And how did that affect your movie career? I mean, you weren't here making movies for several years.
No, but I made movies in Europe, and I made some good ones.
Which ones did you make in Europe?
Well, I made The Fixer. I made a movie called The Horseman. I made Impossible Object, French Connection 2. And I had a pretty active career over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you about French Connection 2. The way I understand it, Gene Hackman called you, said they want to do a sequel to French Connection 1. Why did he call you?
Well, number one, he didn't.
Okay. Tell me the real story.
The real story is that I had a story and Fox had a title. 20th Century Fox had a commitment with Gene Hackman and they had a title, French Connection 2.
Uh-huh.
They had no story. I had a very, very interesting story, which was a narcotics cop being turned into a drug addict. And I thought, and I couldn't get it made, and I thought, wait a minute, this could work for French Connection, too. And I went to 20th Century Fox, and we sold them the idea of this story. And they loved it. And then we sold it to Gene Hackman, with whom I had worked on the Gypsy Moths some years before.
Yeah, well, what happens is, you know, Hackman goes to Marseille to track down the head of this drug ring, and they end up shooting him up with heroin and getting him addicted, and then he has to go through cold turkey. Tell me about the dramatic possibilities you saw in the story that you created here of having the narcotics agent become an addict himself.
Well, I thought it was... I love irony, and I thought that was the ultimate irony, especially to have Popeye Doyle become a drug addict, a cop that was so against this and was so adamant that he would never do this kind of thing, and to have this happen to him. And then, of course, Hackman is such a wonderful actor. The idea of having Hackman go through this whole cold turkey withdrawal was something that I thought the possibilities were endless. And I think he was brilliant in those scenes, incidentally.
Well, some of your early work was in live television doing doing dramas. You did a lot of Playhouse 90s.
I did, yes. I did 153 live television shows.
Yeah, that's really a lot. Was there a lot of improvising required on your part as a director? If something would go wrong, you'd have to just kind of follow through on it.
Strangely, in the 153 shows that I did, very few things ever went wrong. We went into the shows very, very well prepared. Don't forget, we rehearsed in most of those shows for over 3 weeks. We had 4 days on camera. We had a highly, highly trained and expert camera crew. Every shot was predetermined. Every shot was thought out. Every shot had been marked in my script long before we ever got on camera. The most horrendous things that ever happened to me in live television was when I was an assistant director and not in control of my own destiny. I remember when I was an assistant director and Eva Marie Saint and Francis L. Sullivan were on this show, and they were supposed to be flying 50,000 feet above the Himalayas and be crash land and be rescued by these Chinese ski troops. We were in this set, which was about the size of a postage stamp with the two actors, and suddenly Francis L. Sullivan, who was making his live television debut, just went up. I mean, he just couldn't remember his lines. It was supposed to be 50,000 feet above the Himalayas, and he just looked into the camera. He said, my stop. He says, I think I'll get off. And he just got and he walked off the set. And we cut to the camera one, which was on the commercial announcer, and there was no sound on the commercial announcer. And you saw him talking to the agency man, and over this you heard this English accent saying, 40 years in this bloody business, and oh, I've never got up. And suddenly the sound came on over the commercial announcer, and he starts doing the Armstrong Cork commercial. I mean, it was just an unbelievable mess, at which point I was on the phone to Master Control in New York, and we were doing it from New York, and I said, look, you've got to take us off the air. There's nothing we can do now. It's just gone. Do anything. Just run a movie, anything. And they did take us off the air. That's the only time that that's ever happened.
Film director John Frankenheimer, recorded in 1990. He died Saturday at the age of 72. The poet Kenneth Koch also died on Saturday of leukemia. He was 77. Koch was a scholar and a fan of the great tradition of classical European poetry. Writer Ron Padgett said Koch's gift was to combine modernism and lyricism and write poems that gave you a feeling as joyous as Whitman. In the 1950s, Kenneth Koch's circle of friends included fellow poets John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara and painters Larry Rivers and Jane Froelicher. They collaborated on artistic projects and became known for their defiantly anti-academic stance. Some critics dubbed them the New York School of Poets. In 1987, I asked Koch to read an excerpt from his poem Fate about his relationship with Ashbery, O'Hara, Rivers, and Froelicher.
I went to Europe for the first time when I was in my early 20s, and my friends, my best friends, Frank and John and Jane and Larry, they hadn't been to Europe yet, and I was all excited about my time in France, and I came back with some whiskey I'd gotten in Shannon, Ireland, where the planes used to stop, and tried to tell them how wonderful Europe was, and they wouldn't pay any attention to me because they hadn't been there and they were interested in other things. Later on, it always seemed to me this was sort of a wonderful moment in my life, though I didn't know why. I called it fate. In a room on West 10th Street in June of 1951, Frank O'Hara and I and Larry Rivers I actually do not remember if Larry was there, but he would be there later some winter night on the stairway, sitting waiting, a demented telephone, as Frank said in an article about him. But then on the stairs, unhappy in a youthful manner, much happened later. Frank, John Ashbery, Jane Freilacher, and I had just come back from Europe for the first time. I had a bottle of Irish whiskey I'd bought in Shannon where the plane stopped, and we drank it. And I told my friends about Europe. They'd never been there, how much I'd loved it. I was so happy to be there with them. And my Europe, too, which I had. Greece, Italy, France, Scandinavia, and England. Imagine having all that the first time. The walls were white in that little apartment, so tiny. The rooms are so small, but we all fitted into one and talked. Frank, so sure of his talent, but didn't say it that way. I didn't know it till after he was dead, just how sure he had been. And John, unhappy and brilliant and silly, and of them all, my first friend, we had met at Harvard. They tended, except Frank, to poo-poo what I said about Europe. And even Frank was more interested, but ever polite, when sober. I couldn't tell it, but barely tended. They tended to be much more interested in gossip, such as who had been sleeping with whom and what was selling and going on. Whereat I was a little hurt, but used to it. My expectations from my friendships were absurd, but that way I got so much out of them. In fact, it wasn't causal, but the two ways at once. I was never so happy with anyone as I was with those friends at that particular time on that day, with that bottle of Irish whiskey, the time 4 in the afternoon or 3 in the afternoon or 2 or 5, I don't know what. And why do I think that my being so happy is so urgent and important? It seems some kind of evidence of the truth, as if I could go back and take it, or do I just want to hold what there is of it now?
Poet Kenneth Koch, recorded in 1987. He died Saturday at the age of 77. We'll feature our postponed interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, director of Men in Black and Men in Black 2, tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mother Rocket, a collection of stories by Rita Cerisi, author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Somebody, if you want to party, say party. Party.
Coming up, Adventures on the Wheels of Steel. We talk with hip-hop innovator Grandmaster Flash about developing his turntable scratching and mixing techniques. He has a new CD mixing dance hits of the 70s and 80s.
Because we got a beat that just won't end, so you better get ready to rock, my friend. See, we got some news that you can use, and off of that you can't refuse. We're giving up, honey, and you got to come, because you're the one. Red, yellow, black, white, or brown, in our own way, or we can all get down. Just take your time and enjoy yourself, and you'll rock as good as anyone else. So come on, go through it, put your body in. If the feeling is good, you might as well do it. See, it makes no sense. I'm just standing around. Just boogie to the beat of the funk. Yeah.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Grandmaster Flash, is one of the pioneer hip-hop DJs. In the 70s, he developed mixing and scratching turntable techniques that became part of the basics of hip-hop. He started off DJing records at parties in the South Bronx. His group, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, were one of the first hip-hop groups to break out of the local scene and become an international success. We'll hear some of his classic recordings a little later, but let's start with a track from his new CD, Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix Classic Edition, featuring his mix of dance hits from the 70s and 80s. Music from the new Grandmaster Flash CD, the Essential Mix Classic Edition. Grandmaster Flash, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
I'm interested in how you started mixing music, how you started using two turntables or maybe even more than two. Was this something you started doing at home or in clubs as a DJ?
My love for vinyl and for the turntables probably started off when I was a toddler, you know. Growing up at home, I was pretty fortunate to be around a montage of different types of music. Like my sisters, my bigger sisters were into like Tito Puente, Joe Patan. Like my father was into like Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, Cab Calloway. My mother was like into Ella Fitzgerald, Lena Horne, stuff of that nature. So and I had a sister that was like into the Michael Jackson sound. So I was pretty fortunate to grow up listening to quite a bit of vinyl. And my love for it probably came about when I was old enough to sort of start looking into turntables and stuff of that nature. And that's probably, you know, although it was a negative experience. And when I say negative, meaning like I used to just sort of take apart electrical items in my mother's house, including turntables, just to figure out how they work and why they work. And my intention was to put it back together properly, but I just could not do it. But I just had this thing where I just had to know how the inside of a turntable worked, how the inside of a radio worked, and how my father's stereo. And that's probably where it really started, just like I had this undying interest of
Well, you basically started using turntables as if they were instruments. How did you start using turntables to change the music that you were listening to as opposed to just playing the music?
Well, I think coming up, I watched a lot of DJs in my early teens. And watching the DJs of that particular time, they were playing the music. Like my influences, although they were great positive influences. I'm talking about DJ Kool Herc and Pete DJ Jones. These two DJs inspired me to do what I did. And they would play the music, and I just sort of felt like I can take the most exciting part of a record, which we call the break, and sort of extend that, because a lot of these songs that I was listening to were like obscure funk tunes where the break section was like maybe 10 seconds long. And from a frustrated point of view, I had this thought that if I can just come up with a way of just taking duplicate copies of the record with two turntables and a mixer, I can extend that five or 10 second part seamlessly and make it 10 minutes if I wanted to. And that's, you know, my thoughts manifested into creating an art form called the quick mix theory, which is actually taking a passage of music or two duplicate copies of vinyl and sort of moving the disc back and forth and repeating a section of the passage, you know, between duplicate copies of the record. That's where it started.
So you'd let like the 10 seconds play on one record and then switch to the other turntable, and meanwhile back up the first turntable to the beginning of that part of the record.
Exactly. And that was called the clock theory, yeah.
Because you were putting the needle down on exactly the right part of the record with the rhythm that you wanted to hear, could you actually, you know, some people say that you were able to look at the grooves of a vinyl record and know exactly where the rhythm was that you wanted, that you could actually see it in the grooves.
Well, actually, you know, I was pretty decent at it, but it was my first student that I taught this quick mix theory to, Grand Wizard Theodore, was probably the best at that, and it was called needle drops. But what I came up with is what I call the clock theory, and the clock theory was where you would place the needles down on both copies of the vinyl, and when the ending of one was over, you would push in the next fader, but while the other one was playing, you would sort of spin the record back one or two revolutions to the top of that break, and then when the other one was over, you would push in the other. So it was like push, spin back, push, spin back. So I actually never, you know, this made it an assured way of being able to get back to the beginning of the break section without actually having to pull the needle up. And what I would do is I would mark, like on the label, if it was like a record from a, if it was a 12-inch from Atlantic Records, and if the break began at, let's just say, at the top of the A, I would sort of put like a magic marker right there. So that would be my clock of where I had to bring the record back to one or two revolutions back to re-arrive at the top of the break. And I would just sort of do this with two copies of records back and forth. So picking up the needle, you know, was no longer an issue because that day wasn't definite, because once you picked it up, you know, I could always get close to it, but it was never really, like, exact. And creating the clock theory, which all DJs use today now, where they mark the album at a certain point, is one of my contributions to the art of the DJ mix.
My guest is Grandmaster Flash. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Grandmaster Flash, one of hip-hop's pioneers of the turntable. He developed some of the mixing and scratching techniques that became basics of hip-hop. Now, was scratching something that you invented, or was that invented by one of the people who influenced you?
Well, actually, it was called cutting, and the whole thing was, like I said earlier in the interview, it's called the quick mix theory, and we called it cutting because it was actually taking a section of the rhythm and rearranging it. And this is something that I've created over 27 years ago. It's now called scratching, which is sort of just like one part. It's almost like, you know, saying to a boxer, he's boxing, but now we're going to call it right hook. You know, the right hook is only one area of a boxer's skill, and like the scratching is just one area of what this thing, you know, entails. You know,
scratching, just for any of our listeners who don't know what scratching is when you're moving the record back and forth with the needle on it, and the sound of the needle scratching the record creates part of the rhythm track that you're going
right
for.
Because of sort of sound.
Yeah. So, exactly. Did you practice that a lot at home, so you could just like really play these turntables as instruments and do exactly what you wanted on them?
Yeah, I sort of, I was looking for something because at this time, when I wanted to come up with this science, there was no point of reference, no blueprints around. So I was constantly at it, yes, but I was looking for something. And as I was looking for something, you know, I would run into obstacles. So that's when, you know, I had to start considering coming up with different techniques, which is like torque versus inertia for turntables, you know, because a lot of the turntables, like you can buy a turntable now that's suited for whatever you want. You want to do this, you can buy a turntable for that, or a mixer or a needle. But at this particular time in the 70s, this stuff didn't exist. So I had to like actually come up with science and terms and terminologies, you know. And with turntables, I came up with this thing called the torque factor. And the torque factor is based on if from the state of inertia and you press that power switch, if that platter takes more than a turn to be up to speed, then the torque of that motor wasn't very good, you know. So in my search, you know, I went through countless amount of turntables. So I had to actually create the electrical items first before even coming up with the quick mix theory. And then I had to go look at needles, and then I learned that needles, you know, were in two classifications, which is one is the elliptical and the other is the conical, you know. And conical, although it doesn't sound as good, it stood in the grooves better because it was shaped like a nail versus like an elliptical stylus that was built like a backwards J. But as soon as you would bring the disc back, it would fall out of the groove. So, you know, all these things had to come into play before I even was able to even start doing any cuttings, scratching, or whatever the case may be.
You must have been pretty obsessive at that time, taking apart turntables and shopping for just the right needle and, you know, designing all these variations on the technology that you were using so it could do what you needed it to do. You must have really been intense.
Well, I probably was more frustrated than anything because, I mean, so much stuff I had to buy. Like, a lot of it was trial and error, you know. Trying to get my hands on the right needle. You know, I had to go through countless needles, you know, trying to find the right turntable. I had to go through countless turntables and then finding the right mixer and then finding the right mixer. But then it didn't have a system where I can pre-hear the music in my head. So I had to create something called the peekaboo system. So I had to like actually jury-rig these things, you know, in my frustration. My frustration kept me more, fueled the fire to me just staying at this and, you know, throwing away my teenage years, you know, where, you know, your teenage years is when, you know, you're feeling your oats and you want to go hang out with the girls and you want to go to the parties and stuff. I think I probably lived either like in a junkyard, going through like abandoned stereo equipment, or going through abandoned cars, taking out the speakers and the radios and stuff of that nature. I probably lived in my room more so, you know, just looking for something, you know.
Did you have the money? Did you have the money to buy a lot of stereo equipment?
No, that's why I had to go into backyards and look for stuff sort of like go through abandoned cars or ask people, you know, that might have been throwing away stuff, just, you know, just so that I can just basically have these things. But at this point in time, I still didn't know what these internal parts was. So while I was tearing up all the stuff inside my mother's house and became like public enemy number one with my sisters and stuff, my mother decided to send me to school.
What kind of school?
Samuel Gompers Vocational and Technical High School. And that's where I started to understand, like, what is a resistor? What is a capacitor? What is AC versus DC? What is a transformer? What's a push-pull circuit? What's a diode rectifier? What's a transistorized versus tubes? And what's an ohmmeter? And what's an oscilloscope? And what's a wave? And, you know, I started, like, actually understanding as I was, you know, not so now when I tore into something, I sort of had somewhat of an idea of what it is and what it did. So all these things helped me to jury-rig and put together, you know, this peekaboo system to a mix that I didn't have it, and to figure out, you know, how turntables work and how that works. So it kind of helped me to put together the system so that I can start on getting this concept out of my head that just kept, you know, it just kept staying in my head, so to speak.
Why don't we listen to one of your now classic recordings, and this is The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel.
You see, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Fat Bob Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ spinning, I said, my, Flash is back. Flash is fast, Flash is cool, Francois,
Sipa,
Flash ain't
no dude. You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
That's Grandmaster Flash from the early 80s, one of his classic recordings, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to hear that again, but this time, keep your microphone on and have you describe what you're doing as we listen to it. Here we go.
You see,
Punch Face.
You see,
Spoon and G, Monster Jam. I let it go there.
Time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
It's a Blondie here. Punch Face. Punch Face. Back to Spoonie again.
Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Into Good Times, Chic. Into Apache on the Rub. Cutting it up. Back in again. Punch Face, Queen, another one bites the dust. In. Cutting into rhythm. I'm using Good Times to rub the rhythm against Queen. Good Times by Chic.
That release is so nice, the way it synchronizes there.
Thank you. That's the whole key to it, you know. That's what my contribution is, keeping it on time. That was like the key.
Grandmaster, cut faster.
It's I Punch Bass from Freedom.
Grandmaster, cut faster.
Cutting it up.
Grandmaster, cut faster.
Punch Face in Good Times. Back to Good Times.
That's Grandmaster Flash walking us through his recording, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, recorded in 1981. You know, the way Good Times and Queen's Another One Bites the Dust, the way the rhythm of the two work together is really good. What made you think about putting those two together?
They were two pretty big songs at that particular time, and they're almost in the same key. They're almost identical in the way that the bass is being played, and they worked really well in the club back in the days. So I felt, you know, putting it in the mix was like a real good idea, you know.
Now, when we left off in your development as a DJ, you were still working at home and scavenging audio equipment from junked cars and things like that. Once you perfected your technique and you started working parties and then working in clubs, what was it like for you to see the reaction of the crowds to the thing that you had been doing alone in your home?
Well, I think probably the first time when I first, I guess after maybe a three-year period, when I finally came up with it, I showed my partners Disco B, Easy Mike, and as I was creating it, they were the only ones I would allow to really come into my room and sort of like watch me do this. And I think the first time that I decided that I would show this to the public, it was a outdoor dance, a block party we called it. You can come into the park for free and just, you know, come party. And I think the first time that I showed this, I said to myself, my theory was, if I play the climatic part of duplicate copies of a record, so it'd be like maybe 10 to 15 duplicates back to back, seamlessly, on time, you know, I should have the neighborhood park in an uproar. And when I got the exact opposite, and it's kind of painful that, you know, it didn't work according to what I thought it would. People just sort of just stood there and just stood there quiet. You know, I'm talking hundreds of people. And it didn't get loud and they didn't party. They didn't do what I thought.
Why not?
You know, so I don't know. I'm not sure what it was at that time. You know, because I had all the equations, you know, sort of set. You know, I watch these songs, the songs that I picked, I watched certain DJs play from the beginning, and I knew that at that particular part is where the audience went wild. So I figured, let me just go to the part of these songs and just do them one behind another. But it was just extremely quiet. And it turned out that the real fact of the matter is this vocal entertainment was sort of needed to accompany this new way of DJing. And I made the first attempt, and I was totally horrible of trying to like rap with my mixing, and it was really too much to do at one time because
sure.
it's constantly, you know, it's a constant, you know, taking records on, taking them off, putting them on, you know. So I was horrible at it, and then what I would do is basically put a microphone out on the other side of the table, and anyone that thought that they can verbalize to this newfound science of mixing, please feel free, you know. Everybody failed except for this one person who probably was like the savior of my esteem. It was Keith Wiggins. He was my first MC. He went by the name of Cowboy. And Cowboy had a way of, he reminded me of like a ringmaster at the circus, you know, and he had a very commanding voice. And he came up with a verbalization, like, you know, throw your hands in the air, say this, ho, say party, and this and that. So that was the perfect diversionary tactic to get people off of looking at me and to look at him and do what he says do while I go through a series of breaks, you know, just playing one behind another seamlessly to the beat.
My guest is Grandmaster Flash. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's now the time for the Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five MC.
We're coming.
We're here.
My guest is Grandmaster Flash, one of hip-hop's pioneer DJs. He developed some of the turntable mixing and scratching techniques that became basics of hip-hop. His group, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, had several hits on the hip-hop label Sugar Hill Records. Let's hear one of Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five's big hits. This is The Message, and it's probably the first big rap record that has a social message to it, that's about social commentary as opposed to just being a party record.
Sure, exactly.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge, I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
That's The Message, and the rappers are Melly Mel and Duke Booty. My guest is Grandmaster Flash. Let's get back to your new CD, the Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix Classic Edition. One of the things on here is Blondie's Rapture, and that's one of the songs that you sample in The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, because she mentions you in the song.
Yes.
How did you find out about each other? Do you know?
Well, actually, how it happened was when I was maybe 10 years before I recorded making records, there was a gentleman by the name of Fab Five Freddy who used to come to my parties, but he also had this incredible connection with, like, the whites and the different races of people downtown in the village. So back in the days, he was, like, hanging downtown in the village, but he would come up to the Bronx and party with Flash, Herc, and Bam. And he was sort of like our town crier also. He would go downtown and say, listen, there's this guy's uptown. You guys, you know, this guy named Flash. You got to come, you know, come check him, you know. And he would say to me, I'm going to bring one of my good friends up, Deborah Harry. And everybody at that time knew that name. And I was basically on some, yeah, right, whatever. And then surprisingly enough, a couple of weeks later, he brought this woman to my party. And she watched me play, and she was extremely happy with the way that I played. And said that she was going to write a song about me. I took it as a grain of salt. Didn't really believe it until maybe 2 or 3 months later. And she did it. And she opened up so many doors for hip-hop by doing that.
Well, why don't we close with Raptor, which is on your new mix CD. And Grandmaster Flash, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Music from the new CD, Grandmaster Flash, Essential Mix, Classic Edition. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shura. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I am the man in black. I'm back, breaking the back of the random attacker, so can the flack.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of Men in Black and the new sequel Men in Black 2. He also made The Addams Family and Get Shorty. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Trust me, if somebody ripped out of the depths of your imagination, appears Will Smith. Black suit, the black shades, the black shoes, black tie.